All right, let's get down to business. Acts chapter 1 is about? There you go. Rochelle's walking and talking. There you go. Good to see you guys. Yeah, that's right. Hey, Steve, good morning. Good to see you. Acts chapter 2 is about? Good. Now, immediately after the Spirit falls, Acts chapter 3 is going to be about? That's right. The first sermon is in Acts chapter 2. The second one is in Acts chapter 3. And as a result of that, Peter, John, and the crippled man are arrested. So Acts chapter 4 is about? Good. Peter's defense. He is released after he and John are beaten. And then you get to Acts chapter 5. What's going to happen in Acts chapter 5? You're going to have the first discipline. And who was that? For? That's right. And then you're going to have the second. And that was not just Peter, but who was arrested that time? All the apostles. And then you have the great irony. They were arrested by the Sadducees, who don't believe in angels or the resurrection. And all the 12 apostles were released by an angel to go preach about the resurrection. So just a great irony there. Now, Acts chapter 6 is about 7. Acts chapter 7 is about Stephen's defense or Stephen's death, whatever way you memorize it best. Then we get to Acts chapter 8. Who is the primary evangelist in Acts chapter 8? Philip. And he's the main evangelist just for that one chapter. And by the way, we haven't covered this in a while. What happens in Acts chapter 8, by the way? The focus had been in Jerusalem, but in Acts chapter 8, now the focus goes to two different regions. And what regions are those?
Samaria and Judea.
That's right, Judea and Samaria. You guys got it. And the first individual that we cover in Acts 8 that Philip preaches to is who? Simon the sorcerer. And then the second individual at the end of Acts 8 is the Ethiopian eunuch. There you go. Now, Acts chapter 9, we meet the primary historical figure for the rest of the book of Acts. What is Acts 9 about? Saul's conversion, or Paul's conversion. Then you get to Acts chapter 10, and you have a duplicate of Acts chapter 2, but not with the Jews, with the Gentiles. So Acts chapter 10 is about Gentile, Spirit, Kingdom. And who was the household that the Spirit fell upon again? Cornelius. And what was his job? He was a centurion. There you go. Now, Acts chapter 11, there's a stirring about what's happened in Cornelius' home. So Peter brings back a report to Jerusalem. And then there's a congregation started, and Barnabas goes up to it, and then Paul joins him later. That's primary Gentiles. And what group is that? It's at Antioch, that's right, in Syria. Then you get to Acts chapter 12. What's going to happen in Acts chapter 12? That's right. This is one of the harder chapters to memorize because it's right between two big events, Acts 10 and then the Jerusalem conference and the first missionary journey. But James is martyred, and who puts him to death, by the way? Do you guys remember? Yeah, Herod the Tetrarch. And so Herod puts him to death, and then he also arrests Peter, intending to put him to death, but Peter escapes. That's Acts chapter 12. Something big...
He doesn't escape.
Well, he does, yeah. He's released by the Lord, that's right. He escapes death through the hand of the Lord, so... Yeah, but good point. It's not his own power, it's the Lord's power. So, all right. Now, Acts chapter 13, what begins in Acts 13? First missionary journey, and then what concludes then in Acts 14? The first missionary journey. That's the conclusion of that. So, beginning, conclusion. Acts chapter 15, there's a very big debate amongst the Jews as to whether or not the Gentiles needed to do what? Circumcision and, that's right, keep and follow the law. And so Acts chapter 15 is about the Jerusalem conference. And what was the conclusion that the apostles came to?
Not going to bear anything upon them above what they're not going to put the circumcision upon them that they didn't see that that was necessary.
That's right. Just to keep themselves from idolatry, to sexual immorality, to things that are strangled and from blood. That was the only requirements that were put upon them. And that had nothing to do with the law. It had everything to do with pre-law ordinances that God had already established with man. All right, Acts chapter 16 now. What begins in Acts 16?
Second
The second missionary journey begins. And then we get to Acts 17, and there's three primary cities. Now, remember, in Acts 16, the first missionary journey begins. The primary city where the church is established is Philippi. And who stayed behind in Philippi? Timothy and Luke. That's right. Now, there in Acts 17, we cover three different cities. And in Acts 17, what's the first city we come across? Thessalonica. And then there were people that were more noble-minded in Berea. And then finally, we're going to conclude Paul's sermon in Athens. I feel like we lose more time each day because we cover this, but this is so helpful to ingrain this in our memory, to go through this every single time. So Luke is in Philippi. We know that Timothy is sent back to Thessalonica. So where is Silas likely while Paul is in Athens? In Berea, most likely. We looked at that. All right, let's jump back into Paul's sermon in Athens. And remember, we're just going to do a little bit of recap to understand Paul's sermon more today, to bring it back into our memories. Paul is really confronted by two different philosophical groups. And one of them is called the Epicureans, and one of them is called the Stoics. And when Paul is going to give this sermon, he's going to directly challenge both groups based upon their philosophy and what they believe. The Epicureans, if you remember, they are very similar to what maybe modern-day evolutionists would believe as far as their philosophy. And the reason for that is a couple of things. First of all, they believe the primary goal in life was pleasure. Now, the individual that they followed, he believed that the highest goal in life was actually good pleasure, as in the pleasure that you get from giving to people, or the pleasure you get from being hospitable, or those kinds of things. Just like Jesus said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. That's the kind of thing that he was promoting. His followers got away from that, and what they started to practice is whatever feels good, do it. Because that's the end goal in life, is just to feel good as long as you're here on this green earth. They taught that matter is eternal, which is actually incredible. Because at that day and age, nearly everyone believed in some kind of a deity. It was very uncommon for someone to not believe in any kind of a deity whatsoever. And so they believed that matter was eternal, so they denied that the world was created by anybody. They believed the world was in existence for all eternity, and that they had just been there for however long. They didn't know. They denied the immortality of the soul. Once you were dead, that was it. There was nothing else. And so because of that, there would be no judgment, since there's no immortality of the soul. So that's also going to contribute to this. If there's no judgment, what's going to keep you back from doing what you want in this life? Absolutely nothing, as long as you don't get caught and have to face judgment here, right? And so finally, they denied that gods or any kind of deities have any kind of control over human affairs. They believe that their hands are pulled away from the scene. And so Paul's sermon is primarily going to oppose this philosophy. He's going to answer every single major philosophical point that they come from in his sermon. The second group was the Stoics. And if we remember, they followed a gentleman named Zeno of Cyprus who lived to be an amazing 96 years old back then, which is unheard of. But he taught that the world was created by Zeus. And so they did believe in a deity. They believed that this world had to be created by something. It couldn't have just come into existence all by itself or been eternal. So they attributed that to Zeus. And Paul's going to use their philosophers to directly contradict this conclusion they come to. They taught that self-denial was the highest end in life. In other words, really apathy. You needed to deny emotion. And Brad, you did a better job of explaining this to me after class last time. Could you review what you talked to me about?
It was more of the ultimate dedication to logic and reason, subduing the emotion as much as possible. For those who like
Okay. And that was a better understanding than I had, and Brad explained that to me. This would have been, if I liked his illustration of the Vulcans. They were very logic-based, and so you weren't to be ruled by emotion. And so it would come off as apathy towards everything because you weren't allowed to let your emotion control you. And so love or fear or hate or those kind of things, you kept those at bay. And it was very much a study, understand, do the logical conclusion kind of a thing. And I believe this is going to be the group that's actually going to respond to Paul and those that do. They denied the immortality of the soul in general. They believe that once you are dead also, it's just over, like the rest of the group, or the Epicureans. But there was some debate about that even amongst that group. Some of them believed that when the universe was destroyed, that then your soul would be destroyed at that point. And then others believed that it would be kind of absorbed into some cosmic divine entity when you died, and so you became part of the gods when you died. And you see that thought in Greek mythology, when someone died and then they would kind of, if you ever see a movie, they kind of float up into the stars, and then they all of a sudden a star just appears and they're one of the gods. That's where this idea came from. That's what the Stoics taught, and that's what the Stoics believed. So that being said, let's go back through Paul's sermon. And here's his outline again. This is where we concluded last time. Paul is basically going to approach this from three different perspectives. The first thing he's going to preach and come to a conclusion of is that it is Jehovah, Yahweh, who is the creator of all. It's not Zeus. It's not that there's no creator. But he's going to appeal that it is Yahweh who is the creator of all things. That being said, he is also within the reach of all. Everyone can now approach him, and Paul's going to make the connection that that is done through his son, Jesus Christ. And then finally, that God gives salvation to all. Again, that's going to be done through Jesus Christ. And Paul's going to approach this, we'll talk about it more when we get there, from a different perspective. Rather than talking about love and grace and forgiveness, like he does primarily with the Jews, Paul's going to actually come from a perspective of judgment. And that's the motivation towards salvation. If you don't, there's judgment waiting. And that's going to deal with primarily who Paul is talking to. He needs to address what they believe and the perspective that they come from, that there is no judgment. Yeah, John.
They put a shadow of doubt in their mind that maybe their view was wrong.
And that's exactly it. Is if Paul can try to bring out the truth, and this is just the nature of truth. Paul tells us in Ephesians that what does light do to darkness?
It
exposes it. And Paul writes about that more in 2 Corinthians 4, that the gospel is shining forth, and to those that it is veiled from, in other words, they can't see the light, the God of this world has blinded them. And so by Paul preaching the truth in direct contradiction to what they understand and what they believe, there are going to be some that were blinded by the God of this world, Satan, from understanding the truth. But the goal and the hope was to expose the darkness within them for them to understand the light so that they might come to an understanding of the truth. Was there a hand? No, it's a scratch. Okay. All right. Let's go ahead and read this first section where Paul is going to conclude that it is God who is the creator of all. Now, I don't do this a lot, but I in general, I love the English Standard translation, and I believe they got it wrong here. And this is the first part. Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive in every way that you are very religious." What does anyone else's read there instead of very religious? Very superstitious? Okay. Does anyone else have anything different than superstitious or religious? Okay. I want you to, if you still have your handout, under the section, God is the creator of all, go ahead and look down there. I just want to read a small section. Because I think I wrote it better than I can just speak it from memory. I do that a lot. I wrote this, "However, this does not seem to be the correct translation once again. given the context and what Luke has already shared with us, it is good to note that this Greek word here is also translated one who worships demons. Now, if you remember what we discussed last time, what was the Greek understanding of a demon? It wasn't like a Jew, because when they heard Paul preaching, they said, it sounds like he's preaching some kind of a demon. What was a demon to a Greek, if you remember again? It was like a god. It was greater than a man, but it was not like one of the immortals. And the immortals would have been like Neptune and Zeus and Poseidon. You know, that, well, Neptune is Poseidon. So those kind of gods. They fell somewhere in the middle, but they worshiped them. Now, remember, again, to understand why this might be what Paul is saying, we have to go back to Roman law. According to Roman law, if you are preaching something new, a new religion, what is the penalty for you as a citizen, no matter who you are? You're going to be put to death. Now, this is a council of judges that Paul is in front of. And if you direct your attention back a few verses, they pulled Paul up and said, we want to hear more about what you're saying because this is different. This sounds new. It's my understanding from what we read here that Paul is under some kind of a trial here. They want to figure out, are you preaching something you shouldn't be preaching? Now, if Paul is preaching a new doctrine, a new philosophy, so to speak, then that was going to lead to judgment for Paul. But if Paul were somehow able to say what you're already worshiping, you just don't understand, and I'm going to explain it better to you, does that get Paul off the hook for preaching a, quote, new religion?
Right.
Yes. So Paul here, he's going to say, I understand that you, when it's translated very religious, what Paul is about to address is Paul saying, I understand that you have respect for demons and you worship these entities that you believe are somehow above men and below the gods, and you call this entity the unknown God. That makes better sense with what we see here, because he says, for as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. So this makes better sense if you understand the context this way. Read it this way. Paul says, men of Athens, I perceive in every way that you are worshipers of demons or worshipers of these entities. How do I know this? Well, as I passed along the objects of your worship, I found an altar to this one, specifically to the unknown God. What therefore you worship is unknown, this I proclaim to you. Are you able to see what Paul just did here that was absolutely brilliant? He found this inscription that wasn't to an immortal. It would have been to some kind of a deity that they believed was like a demon. And that's what they believed he was preaching. And it says to the unknown God. They just don't know much about him. And so Paul says, this is what I've been preaching about, is this deity right here that you recognize, but you don't know at all. You don't know anything about. So this is going to give Paul an opportunity to preach the gospel without fear of persecution. He is not going to be charged for preaching something new. In fact, he's better explaining that which they already worship, in which he's going to explain how they ought to be worshiping. And so Paul is just, I'm really impressed with what he does here. He, and no doubt the Spirit is guiding him. But what a way to be quick on your feet for Paul, to understand where he's at and to still find a way to preach the gospel to them without causing offense to where they would shut their ears off and want him to be stoned to death right away. Yeah.
Have you been able to find out, does this mean that they just wanted to be sure and cover all their bases? Or does this mean that they observe things in life and in law and in everything that they couldn't attribute to any of their other gods.
Got it. Okay. So Rochelle's question is basically, why is the what's the purpose behind this deity? Was it, in her words, to cover all their bases, to make sure they were worshiping everything they needed to worship? Or was it because there were some things they couldn't attribute to the other gods? Well, it depended on your philosophy. If you were an Epicurean, you didn't worship any of these things because you didn't even believe in the gods. But if you were a Stoic, you believed that Zeus was the all-powerful, but in general, people back then were not monotheistic, they were polytheistic. They believed in many gods. And we're going to understand, Paul is going to change how they thought of the gods. In their mind, the gods were not righteous beings. What were the gods in Greek philosophy?
Just like men.
And even more so, they were egotistical, they were sinful. And the whole motive behind worshiping these gods was to keep them at bay from causing more havoc in your life. So the biggest possibility why they worship this unknown god is because of some kind of a havoc that was taking place or something within their life. And they felt the need that they don't really know what's happening, but they're going to try to worship this deity that they don't understand to try to keep these things from happening again, to keep him at bay. But remember, we don't know whether this was even a popular deity. Remember the numbers? How many idols were in Athens that they've numbered at this point, at this time? It was up to 3,000 different idols. So we don't really even know if this is one that they was popular or not. I would argue maybe perhaps that was one they recognized because Paul addresses it to their knowledge, but we don't know. But this is where Paul begins. And so that being said, his groundwork is laid, his bases are covered, he's cleared. Now he's going to preach that which is the gospel and which is truth. Now again, he's not going to start with Scripture. Why is Paul not going to start with Scripture? All right. It's kind of like, and I've had discussions with brethren about this. Some brethren teach, no matter who you talk to, you always have to start with Scripture because it's the Spirit and the Word that convicts men. And I'm not in argument about what the Word does. But if someone has no respect for the authority of God's Word and they don't believe it at all, are you going to be able to convince someone that they need to honor Jesus Christ because the Bible said so? You need to start with common ground where they are and work your way towards that. And that's exactly what Paul does. He's going to start with what some of them already believe, that this world was created. And so Paul goes on and says, "The God who made the world and everything in it, being the Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and boundaries of their dwelling places." So there are five direct things that Paul is actually going to address here and directly contradict their philosophy. The first thing is Paul proclaims that Yahweh, Jehovah God, is the one who created the world and all things in it. Now, how would the Epicureans understand this statement? What did they believe about creation? They said no one created it, that it's always been there, it's eternal. Paul directly contradicts their belief. Now, the Stoics, on the other hand, who did they believe created all the world? Zeus. And Paul corrects him and says, "This which you worship is unknown." This is the creator of everything. It's not Zeus. In fact, it's Yahweh. It's the God of Israel. And that being said, secondly, Paul says he is the Lord of heaven and earth. Now, if someone is the Lord, what's another word for Lord? Master. The master or ruler of heaven and earth. If someone's the master or ruler of heaven and earth, that means they have control over everything that takes place within heaven and earth. Now again, the Epicureans, what did they believe about divinities in their hand with things in this world. They believed that it was a hands-off policy, that there were no gods that had any kind of control or did any kind of thing to determine the events of this world. And here Paul says something that would directly contradict that. Now the Stoics believed that even the Creator was subject to what they called the fates, and that whatever that decided, that's what happened. So Paul directly contradicts them and says, it is the Lord who is the ruler and the master over everything that takes place within this world. The third thing Paul does is he gives a greater understanding into the nature of who God is, because he says that this God does not live in temples made with hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. We need to understand how Greeks did things. When you look at just the area that Paul's in, you can imagine him turning and pointing to the temple of Apollo, and then turning and pointing to the temple of Ares as he's giving this sermon in the Areopagus, because they literally believed that their gods lived there within these temples, and they believed that these gods needed served by men to survive. And if you didn't feed the gods, guess what would happen to the gods? They would get angry, and sometimes, if no one worshiped them anymore, they would eventually die. Which is just, so the Greek philosophy behind this was like this, I scratch your back, you scratch my back relationship with the gods. We'll keep you alive and kind of worship you, and you don't make everything go wrong amongst us as people. Paul completely contradicts everything they would have understood. And he says, this God, he does not dwell in temples. We might think of Solomon after he built the temple. And he says, I don't know why I did it anyway, because God doesn't dwell, you know, in this, not the whole earth could contain him, much less this house I've built. And so we think about that, and this would have been just something that they did not understand, that they had never heard before, because the gods lived in the temples and you had to serve the gods because they needed it. Paul says, no, God does not need anything from us. In fact, he's the one who even gives you life and breath, everything you need to survive. Yeah, Dave.
Yeah, I like that part about he doesn't dwell with us in the temples that are made by man. But yet, these Stoics, they built elaborate temples. And even there in Jordan by the main museum there, there's a temple to Hercules, and we saw that when we were there. And these pillars are huge. They put a lot into these things to appease their so-called gods. And so they're very elaborate. They stand to this day, many of them, and they're big tourist traps and, mm-hmm. and what have you. But just to see that, you see all of what happened. I can imagine what it looked like in Paul's time. It was everywhere.
Yeah.
And they gave a lot of homage to these things. And for Paul to do this is just amazing.
That's right. So the fourth thing we already addressed, it would have been the relationship between God and man. It is not an I scratch your back, you scratch my back kind of a relationship. Paul does not claim that God is served by human hands, but his claim is the complete reverse, that man is served by the hand of God. Now that's also going to just blow their mind, that there's a God that serves man. And Paul's going to come back to that in just a few moments. But the fifth thing is Paul says that since God is the Lord of all nature and all creation, that it is God that has determined the periods and boundaries of their dwelling place. Think about it like this. We think of the cup of wrath. When Israel filled up their cup of wrath, God sent another nation to destroy them. God was in charge of periods and boundaries. We know in Romans 13 that no authority is in existence other than that which has been given by who? God. It is God who is in control of nations that rise and nations that fall. And again, this would have been the same contradiction to what they believed, because the Epicureans believed there was no hand by the gods. that they arose to power by their own great might and how wonderful and great they were. And Paul here says, nuh-uh. The reason you're here is because God put you here. And it is God who is in control of all of these things. And so this is the first section that Paul tackles to completely contradict where they come from. And based on this, if God is the creator, and if God is the master, and if God is the Lord, it's going to elicit some kind of a response from us. And so Paul goes on to say that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way towards Him and find Him. This is the idea that Paul uses of a blind man trying to feel his way through the city. And what Paul is saying here is you have been blind, but despite your blindness, you can still find your way to God. And you can still feel your way to Him despite being blinded by the god of this world, Satan. Yet He is actually not far from each one of us. Now, there's a whole lesson there. How many times in our life do we feel like God is so far away? Or we feel so far away from God? And yet, what's the promise from James in James chapter 4? Resist the devil and he will be far away. But draw near to God and He will draw near to you. James understood this same thing, and Paul says it in this way. Verse 28, for in Him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, for we indeed are His offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. Now, what Paul does next is very, very interesting. Let's start here, though. Paul says that they should seek God. The Epicureans believed that you should seek pleasure, that was the greatest goal in life. The Stoics believed that you should seek logic and reason, and that was the greatest goal in life, and not being controlled or mastered by anything. Here Paul says, no, the greatest pursuit in life is seeking God, is seeking Israel, is knowing Him. And then there's some debate about this as to exactly where these come from. But Paul is now going to address their own prophets. And he's going to quote from their own prophets and poets to support the conclusion that he's come to. Now, before we do that, Paul is not, by doing so, claiming that these are legitimate prophets that prophesied from God. He is not putting his stamp of approval over everything that they wrote. But he's taking what they did write, and he's going to say what they proclaimed, they didn't understand what they were saying, but it actually works when you put it in the right place, when you talk about it in relationship to the God of Israel. And so, the first person that Paul possibly quotes, this first expression, in Him we live and move and have our being, that is thought to be quoted from Epimenides of Crete. And that would have been a philosopher and a kind of a prophet poet, but there's some debate about whether that quote comes from him. The next one they're absolutely certain of, and that is, for indeed we are His offspring. And that is a direct quotation from the writings of Erastus in 270 BC in his poem Phenomena. And the same ideas were also found in the writings of Cleanthes, who lived from 300 to 220 BC. Brad, you had your hand up.
Just one of my notes in my reference here, a scripture that said the Epimenides person was perhaps something he did when he came to sacrifice, I don't know how many sheep or lamb, came to Athens to sacrifice all these sheep on altars that did not have
any kind of inscription.
God, and that's where the unknown God altar came from.
Mm-hmm. So, that being said, Paul is then going to use these philosophers to point to God. And he's going to say, they recognize that we only have life from Him, And they also recognize that we are his children. Now, Paul's going to use some logic and reasoning here. The old expression is like father, like son. The son resembles the father. And so Paul's argument is going to be, if we are his offspring, God's offspring, then are you gold or silver or sticks? No, I'm not gold, I'm not silver, I'm not sticks. So Paul says, why would you then, if we are his offspring, then turn around and say that the God that created me is this tree right here? That this is my God that created me. No, no, no. God formed you with his hands, but the contrary was the Greeks actually formed the gods with their hands. And so Paul just pulls out this ridiculous notion and calls them on it. And he says, how could you possibly believe that you were created by the gods and then turn around and fashion them with your hands and then fall down before this rock and say, this is the God that fashioned me with its hands? It doesn't make any sense. So Paul says, if we are his offspring, then that automatically in and of itself shows you that God is not anything like you attribute the gods to be. And they would have been beautiful, fanciful, as Dave pointed out earlier. They would have been magnificent to look upon, but only by human terms. Brethren, how much more magnificent will it be to look upon the face of the Creator than to look upon some stone statue that some guy worked on and chiseled? At the end of the day, guess what? It's a rock. It's a stick. The prophets and the Psalms mock Israel for getting into idolatry. And one of my favorite sections, it talks about you form this God with your hands that doesn't hear, that doesn't smell, that doesn't breathe, that doesn't walk, and you need to move, so you have to pick him up and move him somewhere else to make sure your God gets there, and then you set him down, you fall down and worship him again. And just causing them to realize how ridiculous they are for worshiping a rock. You know, if you guys saw me falling down before a rock, you'd take me away, because that's just ridiculous. And so Paul is bringing out how ridiculous what they believe and what they're doing actually is. Yeah?
Just a quick side note, this poet Epimenides was also quoted in Titus 1:12, when the quote is, the Cretans are always liars and gluttons, and it's the same poet. Mm-hmm. He's also quoted in Titus. Again, not everything he said was right, but some things were made applicable to what the Corinthians said.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Brad?
Mm-hmm. Let alone him himself.
That's right. That's right. And so what a thing it will be to witness God's eternal glory for what it actually is one day. So that being said, Paul is now going to say the times of ignorance God overlooked. But now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. And this is how his sermon ends. Let's just address this first statement to begin with. The times of ignorance God has overlooked. Some people have looked at this and believe that means that everyone before this time period got a free pass. In other words, that God didn't care about sin. That's not what Paul means here. Reese does a really good job of addressing this. I didn't put it up there. Let me read you this. He says, God, when he was giving a partial revelation, the Old Testament, to the Jews only, looked beyond to the time when the revelation of his will would be complete, the New Testament, and be made to all, Jews as well as Gentiles. Instead of immediately coming and wiping out the sinners, God patiently worked toward the time when there would be a full revelation of his will. That time has now come, Paul insists. So here's what Paul means. God could have wiped out all mankind, and had he done it before? Yeah, the flood. But then that's the purpose for the rainbow, that God wouldn't do it again. And then God, from the beginning of time, he had made a plan, though, that he was going to, at the right time, at the set time, send his son that salvation might be extended to all mankind, Jew and Gentile, by one man, and it's actually the Son of God, Jesus Christ. And so what Paul is proclaiming is that before this was not the case, but now you are living in the time. God has, it is now this time, it is this advent, so to speak, that Christ has come, his Son has come, and salvation can be found by this one man. And now Paul is going to introduce two completely foreign ideas to both the Epicureans and the Stoics, and then we're out of time. Paul says, because he has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed, and this he has given assurance by raising him from the dead. Two things real quick. Well, three things. First of all, Paul says there's going to be a judgment. Epicureans and the Stoics didn't believe in the immortality of the soul, which in and of itself, for them, there was absolutely no judgment. But Paul here calls to their attention, you are going to be judged by your actions. And at this point, Paul has convicted them that they are idolatrous sinners and that they're foolish men. And the only way in which they can find salvation from this judgment is if they turn from those actions to this God who is not actually far from them. But what would have completely thrown them for a loop is he says here that he will judge them in righteousness. If you read about the rest of those Greek gods, they were not righteous. You know, Zeus, who the Stoics believe created the whole world, there are so many stories of Zeus coming down to earth and raping women and killing people and then going back up and just having a good old time being drunk. That's what they thought about with the gods. You did not think of righteousness when you thought of the gods. So for Paul to claim that this God who wants them to feel their way towards him, who they did not understand and did not know, was the creator of all, was the judge of all, but was also righteous, that would have completely been a foreign idea to them. And then they stopped their minds when Paul says that Jesus was raised from the dead. And this is how Acts 17 ends, and we have to be done. And we won't make comments on the end of Acts 17. You can read your handout or study it yourself. But when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, but others said, hey, we want to hear about this again. And so Paul went out from their midst. He's released. He's not going to be tried for teaching a new faith, a new doctrine. But some of the men joined him and believed, among whom also were Dionysus, the Areopagite, and a woman named Damaris, and others with them. We don't know anything about these folks except for that Dionysius would have been one of the judges at the Areopagus. And he was convinced by what Paul says. Dad, and then we're done.
A quick note, historically, the Areopagus still stands. You can go stand in the exact place where Paul spoke. Ares was the name it's named for. He's got a war. That's the Greek name. It's also
Mars.
Mars
Hill.
Which is the Roman name for the god of war.
That's right.
But Mike Wilson said he actually got to stand at the exact location where Paul would preach this sermon.
How cool.
It's still there.
How cool. All right. All right, we're done. Thank you guys so much.